you were looking into issues around why public policy into the housing shortage is actually misfocused. Can you talk a little bit about what you're actually looking into in this report?
Yes, thanks, Annie, and hello to all listeners on the beloved 3CR airwaves. The report was called Staged Releases, Peering Behind the Land Supply Curtain. And, of course, when it comes to that classic evolution of colonialists to football players to property developers, to MPs, I should say, as well, that sort of cohort works together and essentially government rezones all this land, but it's all care and no responsibility. They don't look at what developers do once they've got the rezoning. They just trust in the market and believe that by sprawling as far as we have, that's the best thing they can do and that competition will naturally evolve. But as listeners may remember from my Renegade Economist radio show, when power is given to those who have a monopoly control of a resource such as land, it's very easy to use that power to extort higher and higher prices. So this is the first major report to look behind this land supply curtain and see what developers actually do once they have everything they ever wanted.
It's funny, isn't it? Because the argument has always been, and it seems like a naturally occurring argument, that the reason for why there is a housing unaffordability problem is the one that was put forward, which is not enough land and the government breaks on that land being delivered, you know, like the land taxes and all those kind of things. That kind of red tape. But you've actually looked into this and you've found that actually because you've got private companies, developers with stock shareholders and all that sort of stuff, that actually their focus isn't actually on housing affordability, and you'd never expect it to be.
Yes, that's right. Developers always blame red and green tape, but through this report we came to realise that there was another sort of tape. It was actually gold tape that developers hold once they get the rezoning to drip feed the land out according to the state of the market. So we looked at 9 master planned communities between Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria, and they controlled 110,000 housing opportunities, and over an average 9.5 years, only 24% of those lots were sold to the market. So what we found behind the land supply curtain was that when times were buoyant and the market was running hot, of course the developers could find the builders, they could do all the paperwork, they could jump any hurdle to sell, often 50%, 80, 90% more supply than what they could when there were tough times in the market. And so here we are in mid-2020, and I'd imagine with interest rates rising, there would be very little supply on the market as developers work feverishly to choke land prices from falling and actually delivering on this affordability promise that lobbyists have called for so long, give us all the supply and that will trickle down to home buyers. And as we know from the 90s, trickle down economics never worked. Same thing here.
Yeah, it's fantastic, sleight of hand. And obviously it's not just developers, it's the financiers that are behind it. As you point out in this development, in this report, that holding on to land can actually give them a return.
Yes, and that's something Dr. Cameron Murray, one of our researchers, has really pushed and helped us all understand that there's something called the option value of, say, those 110,000 lots. If they brought them all on the market, we know prices would drop. But from a shareholder perspective, they know that if they engage in patient capital and hold that land and slowly release it, over time, the value of those 110,000 lots is probably, five, 10 times more if they drip feed it over 20 to 30 years rather than 10 to 15 years.
There was a fascinating case study in near Ipswich where they even obtained a special piece of legislation that gave them complete control. And in the end, it didn't matter if land prices were going up or down, the cost of anything that they sold, they were eventually gleaning something like 303% above in profits in the price.
Yeah, that's Springfield, which is Australia's largest master plan community with some 43,000 lots in development. And after 19 years, they'd only sold 23% of their site. And, of course, government hasn't asked any questions. That over time, the land prices in Springfield, despite all of that supply, had still managed to increase by 8.1% a year above inflation. So, really poor return on public policy. And, this report, we kind of walked a fine line between demonising developers and really holding a mirror up to government and saying, look, you guys have fallen for this hook, line and sinker. How on earth could you think that developers are going to keep building enough houses to undercut their own product?
Yeah, well, it's interesting.
It doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it does make sense. And the other thing that's fascinating is that your work has taken, this report's taken about a decade to actually shape up. And part of it, as you've said, is because of the prohibitive nature, the cost of data and the privatisation of property data.
Yes. Yeah, it cost us thousands to access this data and, go back a decade ago with geospatial analysis coming through, we were really excited about the potential of it to be able to do an animation showing how various elements of community development affected property prices and who won and who lost. Well, of course, since then, a lot of our property data has been sold off to a Californian multinational called CoreLogic, who, interestingly, have also moved to the front of the queue when it comes to climate emergency data and flood data. And it kind of feels like these big boys are using massive algorithms, plugging in all the demographics, and they're just setting themselves up for where we're all going to be forced to move in another 15, 20-odd years. With Lismore, perhaps the canary in the coal mine. The data is very expensive, but if you get to read the stage releases report, have a look at figure one, because this is the key graph that we're trying to get Andrew Leigh, Federal Labor, to get us into the ACCC, because remember Richard Pratt, the Visi cardboard box king who got done for meeting in an apartment, meeting in a hotel in Carlton with, I think, the Amcor executives, and they faced, $20 million in
cartel.
This sort of cartel thing. And that was when they actually had meetings. But now we've got algorithms where they all look at auction clearance rates, days on market, credit availability, land supply in the region. It's probably 12, 15 different metrics there. And in mid-2017, it was sort of March, April 2017, the auction clearance rate started to soften. And by July, that had continued. But when we looked at what happened to housing sales, basically it had halved within those few months. And there was a strong indication. We can't prove it, but it was an indicator that perhaps developers had seen the market was softening and they need to stay ahead of the market, so they're going to pull the supply that's available available to purchase from the market so that prices will keep heading northwards.
Yep.
And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And if we look at Victoria, because people are constantly wanting to know why is it that there's constant discussion about building house builds and all that sort of stuff? Why is it impossible for there to be any, reform, stuff happening for people who are even in the private housing market? We're not even talking about public housing issues here. We're talking about people who are trying to buy their first home, as it were. So in 2010, you point out that the urban growth boundary and the precinct structure plan in Victoria was expecting to have 110,000 residential lots. Like, that was the big announcement. And despite this, residential land prices increased by an inflation-adjusted 63.02% between 2012 and 21. So what it means for people who are trying to buy into the housing market is that they're paying, hundreds of thousands of dollars more because of the price of the land.
Yes, that's right. And, the ABC quantified that we've probably lost half of our peri-urban food bowl in this drive to give developers everything they want. And there's the response of being given a 63.4% increase in land prices. So, I'm really hoping I get a response from the Housing Minister, Danny Pearson. We've got to get some action on this. I feel like my meeting invitation is dying in his inbox, but the Treasurer's Office has shown some interest in it, so that's good. It's probably time we spoke to the Liberal Party as well and see if they might take any meaningful action on this.
Well, that would be an interesting day in hell, I'd say. Considering if you think about the Fisherman's Bend debacle. But anyway, there you go. But you've actually moved towards, these staged release, this sort of unholy alliance between government and private developers, because they're all in love with capitalism, da-da-da-da-da-da. They think it's the answer, except, of course, it doesn't actually return the favour to the public interest. But you've gone to something else. You've decided to create an NGO called Grounded, and you're supporting the community land trust model. Can you explain that?
Yes, certainly. The for-profit model, this report sort of shoots holes in it, and I got word from a Queensland developer that the government up there has read this report and found that the development industry has a big credibility issue coming up because they've just not given us the returns they promised. What's happening, particularly in the UK, US, is a community-led housing movement where you've heard of tiny homes, you've heard of co-housing. People who used to listen to my show would have heard me rabbit on about community land trust, but we don't actually have one happening in Australia yet. And it's where the rising value of the land is kept within the community rather than allowed to leak to the previous owner or to the banks. So basically that rising land value can pay off the debts within about a decade, and then you've got a reasonable income stream coming through to invest in social ventures that your community may prioritise. And, the land trust model sees the trust own the land, but the resident own the building. So that's saves you around about 60 or 70% in terms of your mortgage interest and the amount of money you need to borrow. So,
What are you saying, that you're isolating the cost of the land from the building that someone's living in?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, exactly. That's it. And in America, during the global financial crisis, the foreclosure rates were 94% lower than in the wider market, because community works together. You get a financial advisor in, and he works with everyone, makes sure everyone's sort of got a good plan. And, you know, you do all the things that we should be doing in a country where, you know, we've had this TV show called Neighbours for so long, until recently. You know, we're meant to be good at engaging with our community, but... you know, it takes a special bond to make those connections, and we'd like to think that those who are looking for a sort of earth-based living system where we respect our neighbours and our community and want to do good things for each other, that this is a much better model to go with.
Does that require legislation?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that really did my head in was... it was about my last radio show. We finally got this rezoning windfall gains tax legislation through in Victoria last November. But tacked onto the back of the bill was the build-to-rent legislation, which Wall Street had rushed through in the last 18 months. And this was to prioritise and lavish them with all sorts of tax handouts so that we could rent from Wall Street. And... yeah, when I saw that, I was like, my God, here I am up on land in central Victoria near Kyneton, Daylesford sort of region, and I've got 27 acres trying to do good things, but I'm having to piece together the Retirement Villages Act with the Caravan Park Act. We need some dedicated legislation so, you know, tiny homes can actually park somewhere. But co-housing is seen as a respectable form of living and not something that's confusing for banks. And for community land trusts, it's all that and more. We really need to provide some socially beneficial housing models to the market, because there's more than enough of us who recognise that we shouldn't be making huge profits out of this human right of somewhere to live.